when people talk about someone being results oriented outside of poker, that's seen as a good thing. In poker, that's like a horrible thing. It's, you use that as like, oh, you're being way too results oriented right now, because you cannot control the outcome of this specific hand. You can control your process. And just because you lost the hand does not mean you made a bad decision. But in day-to-day life, that is like the opposite lesson that's taught. And so I think that mindset is probably the biggest driver of success. But I also think a lot of people with anything, it's like you have the experts in one thing. There's some clever name for it, but it's like experts in one thing assume they're going to be an expert in the other thing. And it's like rarely do skills transfer one to one or even close to that.
So, Andy, we met at the Main Street Summit out in Missouri. You're coming from Maine. I came from Philly. We all met up in Columbia, Missouri to talk about buying businesses. And, you know, I got my EBITDA hat on in the Main Street Summit there. So you're actually the second guest I met from Main Street Summit. I had Will Wilder on from New Image Leasing, and we had an awesome conversation about SBA deals and, you know, how to get the lending for acquiring businesses, which is actually a great segue into your background. So you actually bought a SaaS company in the it's a data platform for daily fantasy sports, you know, players of FanDuel, DraftKings. You know, you've grown it, you know, well over an multiple orders of magnitude since the acquisition. And I'm super excited to dive right in to all that. Did I miss anything on the intro?
No, I mean, I think getting to Columbia was a adventure. I feel like that could be a podcast in and of itself, but we made it. I was glad that to get out there, and I think they put on an awesome event with a lot of interesting people. And for the acquisition of Saberstream, like, to be completely honest, it was doing barely six figures a year. It was more of an acqui-hire than a traditional acquisition, in the sense that it was run by a founder as his side project, never quite got enough traction for him to feel comfortable going full time on it. There were a couple of people kind of helping out part time, but we were incredibly impressed with what he had built, Matt. And it was me, three other partners who've done a lot of work on different gambling things together. My background, I played poker professionally for about a decade, and my friends are some of the highest stakes daily fantasy sports players and former poker players. And we were really impressed with the models that Matt had built, especially for baseball at that time. And we're looking at getting some data from him. Realized it was a very small operation and he was very overwhelmed, and kind of just structured a deal where there was cash up front, but it was more guaranteed salary plus payouts. Honestly structured around the start of baseball season and then football season for a couple of years. And we viewed it as, I was really excited about the business prospects and getting a chance to kind of learn or apply a lot of the things I've been learning myself in the marketing and startup space. But really, we viewed our downside protection as being able to work with an incredibly smart person. And that thesis turned out to be true. We have gained a lot just through working with Matt, but also the business has grown substantially. Yeah. So, I mean, we're now doing mid seven figures a year in recurring revenue, and have learned an insane amount. But it's like the cash component of the deal was, well, at least like all of it was financed by us. But it was staggered out where it wasn't, it didn't need a ton of planning from us for how to do it. It was sort of just tapping into like our gambling bankrolls to fund that. But at this point now it's like building up the team and a lot of learnings there, and I'm definitely like interested in kind of a larger like true acquisition. So I might have to ping you for some advice or an intro to your guest who has more experience on the SBA side of things. But that's kind of how the whole snowball started on our end.
Yeah. So based on those numbers you just said, you know, in 4 or 5 years, you've basically somewhere between like 50 to 80X to the business.
You know, that's like about right.
What levers did you pull to get that kind of growth in that amount of time?
Yeah. So there's been a few, there's a lot of levers that were pulled, but a few really made the biggest difference. And I think it's a combination of like in, at least in the software kind of private equity world, the mantra is just like buy something that's sticky and jack up the prices. And generally that does work. But I think it leaves a lot on the table. And so the biggest thing really that enabled all this was investing significant resources in improving the product and making it so that like, we had something that was worth significantly more to people to enable us to increase prices. And we, at the point at the acquisition spot, I think the plan, it might've been only one plan in my memory, but it was $40 a month. And right now we have three plans. It's $100 a month, $150 a month, and $300 a month. And the $300 a month plan probably drives at least 70% of our revenue. And it's not as though we could have just like changed the price, just 8X the price and immediately done that. In some like B2B SaaS, maybe that is the case, but not here. That was years of intense like product development with the customers and really figuring out what works, what doesn't, what do they care about. But combined with the insight of like, okay, like this is worth more to people than I think most would assume. And so let's leave some consumer surplus on the table for them, but like make sure that we're fairly compensated for what we've done. So a lot of little things along the way, but it boils down to dramatically improving the product, building a strong community around that, which helps us improve the product, and then being willing to price accordingly. Is kind of like the TLDR of it.
So when you acquired the company originally, how far along was the product? And, you know, like, let's say what percentage complete was it at that point versus where it is today?
We have an entirely different product than we did then. And this is like probably the luckiest part of all of it was Matt was... I didn't know what I was doing. So like for due diligence, it was also different in that like we didn't view it as we were buying a business. And so like Matt checked out as far as like an acqui-hire goes. We did kind of a lightweight, not even quality of earnings, but just making sure his reported numbers match up with tax returns and everything, like make sure he's telling everything straight. But we didn't do a ton of due diligence because it was more focused on him. And where we got really lucky was like he was pretty far in development on what he was calling like SaberSim 2.0. And that was an entirely new platform and really tried to take our industry in a different direction. I didn't really know about that. He had mentioned it a couple of times, like I never dug into it until really like after the acquisition. And that let us position ourselves in direct opposition to like all of our competitors, who easiest way to like understand it is we are what's called like a lineup optimizer, where we're going to pull in projections and all sorts of data to help you build good lineups for sites like DraftKings and FanDuel. The competition, the other tools, and still to this day, this is how they are, act like a spreadsheet where they have a ton of power, some more than others, but they all can do a lot, but like they don't have any intentionality or it's just more like, hey, here's a spreadsheet. You've got all the functions you need, but like, you're going to have to make it, you're basically gonna have to program it to get what you want out of it. And a lot of people did figure that out. And there was a lot of content around helping people do that, but it was just like a fundamentally broken process. And through the way we generated our data through our models, we could kind of shortcut a lot of that work for the users. And so it's only been recently that I feel like we've really taken much market share from our competitors, because when you are telling someone who has made money for years doing things a specific way that the way they're doing it is not good, it's just not an argument you're going to be likely to win. And so for where we grew was on the back of all of the serious but still recreational players who tried to figure out these tools and just couldn't get past it. Like, even when I try to use them now, I don't even know where to begin sometimes, and it takes me so much time. So it's like, if you're just doing this as a part-time thing, just literally like a couple hours, you have no expectations of going pro or anything else. Like, you're not going to be able to figure it out.
Like bad product design, you're saying. They don't understand the product's market fit.
Exactly. And they definitely hit a local maximum where it was like, okay, these tools didn't exist. DFS or Daily Fantasy Sports started blowing up in popularity. Someone created this as like the first iteration, and it was transformational because there was so much money in the games and there was no other option. Like, it's a purpose-built spreadsheet where it did let you do more than like you could really do on your own. And so there was strong incentive for people to figure out how to get these tools to work. And a lot of people built really involved processes around this. And to me, a lot of it is it's like trying to read tea leaves, and like, you build this almost house of cards where you're not sure which card, if you remove it, it's all going to come crumbling down on you. It's just these convoluted, complex processes, but you've been getting good results. So you're like, I just don't want to touch it. I just want to keep doing things the same way I've been doing it. But where I think the market failed is no one took a step back and was like, wait a second, like, is this the right way? Are we solving this problem in the right way for the customer? And our answer is like, no. And it took a long time to get the existing users over to us. And there's still a lot that haven't migrated. But the competition dramatically underestimated how large the market was of people that weren't served by the existing tools. And so that was really where our focus was. And so it's like, the product we have now literally doesn't share any code with the version that we bought, and is truly like a completely different product, even just of like our approach. Is like, the way Matt had originally built it had some, it was kind of in between, whereas like, he knew where he wanted to go with it, but it still had a lot of similarities to the existing tools. But now what we have just isn't anything like that at all. Yeah.
So I have an assumption here as to why that worked out really well for you. I'll start by saying, I think it's a common mistake that a lot of software engineers that are becoming entrepreneurs for the first time will over-engineer their products and don't really understand the end user in a way that they build a product that is elegant and empathetic to the end users in a way that it becomes sticky. So my question for you, are you an engineer yourself?
No.
So you're not an engineer, and you were more of like a product manager, probably, I imagine, when you took this over. Like, you were hands-on with what the product needed to be and the vision for the product, but not actually writing the code yourself.
Yeah, so I can't code at all. In a lot of the gambling that I've done, primarily poker, but a lot of it's been very math-based, and I've worked with a lot of software engineers to develop different algorithms and things like that. So like, I'm very familiar with what's going on under the hood, but like, I couldn't build it. And so, yeah, like a deep product knowledge kind of thing where it's like, I'm not going to be hands-on, but it's like, I'll get what has to happen to achieve what we're looking for. But I can't take credit for the direction we've gone. That really is Matt. But then it was he and I working very closely to kind of refine it and keep, it's like, I think he definitely did the first 80% of like picking a direction. And then a lot of it is just me taking advantage of like my kind of anal retentive nature of just like everything annoying me when it's not like just so, and just being like, oh, like this still, like this is definitely an improvement, but it still doesn't seem like we're getting it. Like it's still like, and so just kind of pushing a bit further there.
But so he's like the Woz and you're like the Jobs then.
I won't say that. And I think that that's probably pushing it, but it's like, yeah, he's coming at it where it's like, he can get it. He came up with the initial insight, and then working together, we're able to just like really dial it in to something that, neither of us would have been able to do on our own. And it's, I don't know. I just feel like a lot of people in most things in life just like don't step back and ask themselves, why are we doing it this way? And sometimes I'm sure I drive the team crazy because I'll probably ask that too much, but it's just like people assume that, oh, other people are doing it this way, like we have to operate within these confines, and by default, like that's probably not a bad place to start, but you got to understand, why are they doing that? And are there other ways? And it's most of the time like, no, this is a good path, but it's, I think that's where you can get the breakthrough growth is finding those spots where it's like, oh no, like I think they're just like missing something here.
So I want to go back to the poker stuff, cause that's pretty interesting. I heard the guys on My First Million talk about how the degenerate poker players always make the best entrepreneurs.
I think it's I view it as you're going to, one of the biggest things to me is just like prioritization by understanding like probabilistic thinking, in the sense of people just always say like, oh, this is risky, or oh, this is going to be like, we're going to get some benefit out of this, but they don't try to quantify the scale of either the risk or the benefit, like how big of an impact in either direction is, and then how often does that happen? And it's like, without those components, you miss everything. And it's like when people, casual fans, even serious fans, when they talk about like betting on sports, well, it's like, oh, I guess in this Super Bowl, it was super close, so it's like not the best example, but like any of the times where there's been just a really lopsided matchup, they're like, oh yeah, like earlier, I guess, in the season, it's like, yeah, the Ravens or the Chiefs are going to crush this team. And it's like, yeah, but like, what does that mean by how many points? And then like, okay, what percent of the time? Because if you're just going to take the odds at any amount and in any amount of spread, whatever else, like you're not going to win. And most people just think like, this is going to happen more often than not, or this is going to always happen, or this is going to never happen. But it's like, rarely is it that definite, or I guess like extreme even. It's like there's a huge gradient of possible outcomes, of distribution of outcomes. And in poker, to be successful, you have to like just deeply get that. And you can also see all the times where you can make what is objectively a good decision, but still get a bad outcome. And I think I took it for granted how that is not how most people operate, and like for good reason in everyday life. But it's like in poker, it took me a long time to figure this out. Like when people talk about someone being results oriented outside of poker, that's seen as a good thing. In poker, that's like a horrible thing. It's, you use that as like, oh, you're being way too results oriented right now, because you cannot control the outcome of this specific hand. You can control your process. And just because you lost the hand does not mean you made a bad decision. But in day-to-day life, that is like the opposite lesson that's taught. And so I think that mindset is probably the biggest driver of success. But I also think a lot of people with anything, it's like you have the experts in one thing. There's some clever name for it, but it's like experts in one thing assume they're going to be an expert in the other thing. And it's like rarely do skills transfer one to one or even close to that. And so I think a lot of people have succeeded in other areas from poker, but for different reasons. Yeah. But I think that probabilistic thinking is probably the biggest.
Yeah. Maybe appetite for just taking risk too. I think that's
a big thing
for entrepreneurs. But it's interesting. You say that, like the whole concept of, the process is what you can control. You can't control the outcome. I think that's super true in entrepreneurship as well. Whereas you can't control what the market's going to do, what the customers are going to do. You can just control your process when you're building your company, when you're going to market, when you're refining the product. But ultimately what happens is out of your control. So like that process of iterating and, you know, testing and, you know, continuing to refine your approach and your go-to-market strategy, that's what leads to success, not just hitting the home run on the first try that you take.
Right. And I think another piece of it is in poker, you have to make most decisions are marginal. And at the lower stakes, you can just kind of skip those and just like not take a questionable bet because you know there's going to be enough, the players are making enough mistakes that you can just focus on the clear decisions. But you still have to act because it's like the Buffett phrase is always like, there's no called strikes in investing. It's like, you can't just wait for your pitch. In poker, it's similar, but like you can wait a bit longer. But in business, generally speaking, especially on the investing side, if you're buying a business, you should like, don't just be like, I haven't found a deal in a while. Like, I just need to make something happen. It's like, no, like there's no penalty for not doing a deal. And if it's questionable, it's probably just best not to. And it can be frustrating, it can be hard to have the discipline for that. But I think even in the day-to-day operations, it's like you don't want to be making a lot of marginal decisions. Like you're going to have to, but it's like they just don't matter. So you want to spend as little time on those as you can and instead just focus on the clear bets, which it's like there's Sean Ellis. I forget which one he talked about. It was like ICE. I think it was like impact, confidence, effort. And then there's like PIE. And there's just a bunch of different like prioritization frameworks. But I think directionally, they make sense. But I really feel like they miss the bigger point of like, if you have to quantify like two different decisions to prioritize them, it's like you probably aren't coming up with good options. Like you probably have like a strategic weak spot because you want to find the things where it's just so obvious. If we do this, it's going to have like a dramatic outcome and it's not that hard for us to build and everything else. So like, yes, let's just go in this direction. And then as you get deeper into like smaller decisions and details need to be made. But I think a lot of where we've gotten is just focusing on like a few clearer wins. Like in the earlier days when you don't have much of a customer base, it's not going to be as clear. But like as you get more customers, it's almost always going to be the best option to just figure out how do we give them more value so we can charge more. And like anything that doesn't do that, it's not that it's not a good bet, but like it has to have such a higher outcome, potential outcome, to make it worth it because it's just so much more speculative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to break down that ICE framework for the listeners. Yeah. I love that one. So the impact, confidence, effort. So the impact is like, what's the potential impact, you know, outcome from this decision? And, you know, is it a big, you know, multi-million dollar impact potentially? Is it a small, you know, is it just fixing one tiny little thing that doesn't really matter? The confidence is how confident are you that you can achieve that outcome? And the effort is how much effort will it take to to achieve the outcome. And I love that framework when thinking of decisions, you know, kind of making decisions in a business. And it ties back into another thing that you were kind of making me think of, like the, you know, what's the risk versus reward spectrum. And there's like this famous Bezosism where it's, you know, if you have a 10% chance of 100x return, take that bet every single time.
Right. And it's, but so that's where it's like, he goes further. And it's like the part where he goes further is an important part, but it says like, it needs to be a bet you can afford to make. Because if you lose 90% of the time and that then puts you out of business, it might not be the best bet. Or there might be other ways you need to figure out about how to structure the bet and other things. And like the, I think ICE in those frameworks are incredibly valuable as like a first step. But I think like the way, like the adjustment I like to look at what's called like the Kelly criterion, which is used in sports betting, is used in trading. And it's basically a formula for maximizing bankroll or portfolio growth. It's very aggressive, but like it's going to look at, okay, what is the outcome of this? But how often, and it's really the variables of ICE. It's what is the outcome of this? How often are you going to, if you win, how often are you going to win? And then what do you have to bet? And for Kelly, they solve for trying to tell you how much to bet based on those things. And the more certain you are of the outcome, the less the payoff needs to be to make it be an incredibly good bet. And especially the less you have to bet to get it. But where it can lead you astray is by saying you should bet really heavy on those kind of the asymmetric bets that have 100x outcomes. And you should, but you've got to just make sure it's like it doesn't, you can bet again if it doesn't work out. And yeah, like that, it's really... Exactly. Like it's a really important caveat, because that's absolutely what you're looking for, is what are those things where either I'm so confident in this and it's still going to have a big impact, which a lot of it is like when you find more valuable things you can sell to your existing customers, like those fall in those ones, which Kelly would say you should bet a lot on those. The other side is the ones where the payoff is so massive, you should bet a lot on those, but you will want to bet smaller amounts so that you can place multiple bets, and that if you swing and miss, you're not wiped out.
Yeah, smaller amounts relative to your entire portfolio or holdings.
Right, and like in those earlier days, you don't have those kind of more sure shot things. So it's like you need to be placing a bunch of those bets and trying a bunch of things, waiting to see some traction to figure out where you can double down. But like until you get that initial product market fit or whatever you want to call it, you have to take the big swings, because it's like you don't have anything yet to double down on.
Yeah, I love that. This is a great segment, by the way. Tons of gold here. I'm curious. So we're talking about poker. What's like the biggest hand that you've ever won or lost in poker?
Probably like tens of thousands, but like not more than 50. It's been a while, but I would guess like for a single hand, yeah, probably 20-ish thousand. And so that also has like a very weird impact on how you view money. Where like that was a much bigger game, and I didn't love, obviously you don't love like losing a mass like your biggest hand ever, but it was a good game, and I think overall against that opponent I wasn't up a lifetime, but like you're putting yourself in good spots and they don't always work out, and you have to be willing to do that and to accept the downside risk. And it is just very hard to then worry about like day-to-day budgets and business budgets and other things where I'm just like, this, you have to become desensitized to money to an extent to succeed in gambling, but that's a very easy way to like fail at life by like just like not worrying about it. And that's where I think you see a lot of gamblers who don't aren't thinking about as deeply about like why are they placing this bet, who will lose all of their money because either they're placing bad bets in at the poker table or they're just spewing money everywhere else in their life, where it's like, no, you gotta kind of be like, I'm only placing this bet because I think it is a positive expectation and my bankroll can withstand the swing if I'm wrong, or if I'm right but just end up with a bad outcome.
We're saying, I think it applies to poker or business. I mean, the exact same philosophy is, you know, true for both. And, you know, I think they're, you know, the bigger your business gets, I think, you know, the bigger the checks are, the bigger the payroll is, the bigger the AWS bills are. And I do think that if you're not to a certain degree, like desensitized to money, you might become so risk adverse that you start to like not invest in the business and just sort of let it coast.
Right. And it's one of those things where, I mean, you see it a lot, or at least like from my kind of voyeurism of like watching different deals being talked about on Twitter or podcasts or whatever else, but like of the retiring founder who hasn't of a local SMB that's been running for 30, 40, 50 years, and they haven't been reinvesting in the last 5 years because it's like they're getting ready for retirement and they don't want to replace the fleet of trucks, even though it needs it and all these other things. And like, it's, yeah, you can see that under investment to like maximize cash to lower risk or just for other reasons. And it doesn't seem rational, but sometimes people have different ways of measuring that. But I think, yeah, you've got to be comfortable placing those bets. But I think more than that, it's I feel like there's a lot of motion and a lot of activities and a lot of things that every business does that they don't think about, like, how much am I betting on this? And like, is this actually worth it? And we fall victim to that all the time. And it's like, we're kind of going through like a regular, like cleanup phase of like, okay, like what are all the things that we're doing kind of regularly? Do they actually add value, or do they add enough value to make up for the amount of time our team is spending on it? And I think in a lot of cases, the answer is like, if it's questionable, it's not going to hurt to cut, but then you have to think about like, okay, like, is there a better use of that person's time? Is this just filler time? And like, it's plausible how this could have a return or whatever else. But like, I think those are the things that matter a good amount, but often get overlooked. Like, I overlook them all the time. Like, that's, we're kind of like trying to catch up on some of those things.
So I have a question for you, and I want you to answer it from the poker player perspective and from the business perspective. Okay. So how much of your bets would you say are like mathematical and quantified versus gut feeling and intuition?
In poker, it was basically like, I worked with game theorists to develop algorithms to create strong, not technically optimal, but like quasi-optimal strategies. Basically, like, if you play this strategy in the long run, you will at the very least not lose. And then if your opponents are making mistakes, you should theoretically gain. You can't like follow those strategies perfectly when you're playing. You can't have advisors or other tools to help you do that. So you would have to like make a study tool and other things to like train yourself on the different scenarios. And so in poker, my application wasn't perfect, obviously, but like, it was all still based purely on math. In business, I just really feel like if you have to do the math, you're not giving yourself good options. It's like, maybe you have two amazing options, but like, still, like if you have to do the math to decide between the two, just flip a coin. Cause like, if it's that close, it doesn't matter. They're both going to be great. But I think what happens more is people just get, they don't think enough about what is the actual outcome of this and like how many things have to go right for this to have that payoff. And do we have the people internally or the skills internally to make this likely to succeed? And I think it's like a lot of people just put themselves in a situation where they're just evaluating shitty bets. And it's more trying to find the ones where it's just like super obvious. This has a lot of potential. And so for us right now, there's kind of, we're balancing it between those more speculative, like asymmetric bets and those more confident raising the value ladder bets. And so it's like basically have like one big kind of like annual goal in both areas and then some different projects under that. But within those, it's just like, okay, there's a lot of other things we could do, but I don't see how they would have enough payoff or enough certainty to really like measure that. And I think that's where it's like, where I can get led astray is sometimes it's just like on bugs, on other things. It's like, okay, like this is not worth our time to fix. Like it's not even worth our time to investigate a lot of them when compared to, because it's like, okay, this could just be user error. This could be an actual bug, but it might just be impacting this one user. And if we don't fix it, are they going to cancel because of it? And so it's like the cost for us is very real of the time spent away from the bigger priorities to investigate, to fix, to do all that. And there might not actually be a negative cost to not fixing it. And I think when you look at those in isolation, that's almost always going to be the answer. It's a question of then when, like, what if there's a bunch of those and it's not an isolated and this person's had five different bugs and a bunch of other customers are having similar ones, then it's like, okay, like it's easy to get a bit too siloed on things and not look at the bigger picture.
I want to take a quick break from the episode and say, if you're enjoying this content, the best way you can say thank you is to subscribe. So if you're on YouTube, hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. And if you're on one of the podcast platforms, hit the subscribe button there as well. And also share it out to your friends and colleagues. If you find this content useful and you think other people will enjoy it as well, please send it out. And back to the episode. All right. So the next thing, that was all like super awesome information. You're dropping a lot of gold here on this episode for a lot of entrepreneurs. Next thing I wanted to dive into with you is SaaS metrics, because we were riffing on SaaS metrics a little bit in the pregame here. And, you know, you talked about some SaaS metrics that, you know, I'll use air quotes, the experts would advise against. But, you know, like for instance, churn, like if your business has a certain churn rate, it's a bad business. But, you know, in your space, you know, it might be common to see higher churn, but your customer acquisition growth rate, like you're acquiring customers so fast that the churn doesn't really matter as much. So I'd love to kind of like dive into that a little bit more too and see, you know, kind of like what, how you look at SaaS metrics, how they apply to different categories, like a B2B enterprise SaaS versus a consumer or prosumer SaaS, and what those metrics kind of mean to you.
Yeah, I think so much of the advice in SaaS comes from a B2B perspective, and it makes sense why. I mean, that's where the vast majority of like VC investment goes, and it's where the biggest companies are for like true SaaS. But I think it's the same thing as anything. It's like people don't question why are these the best practices in this area, and like they just kind of apply the same rules of thumb everywhere. And so for like churn, it's like you'll see, yes, for B2B enterprise SaaS too, of not just like SMB, but like enterprise SaaS, it's like, yes, you should have not just sub 1% churn, but like ideally you have like positive revenue retention year over year from those customers. So it's like actually like you might be losing logos, but the logos that you keep are growing. And like, yeah, that's awesome. But you also see like if you're at 5%, your business is on fire. If you're at 10%, your business is dead. And it's just like, doesn't have to be true. I mean, like we're at probably 20% churn. Monthly churn. And so everyone's like, yeah, if you do an Excel spreadsheet, yeah, we're going to asymptotically approach zero in months. It's like, no, like we haven't though. And I think that's where people, there's a lot
of this. 50 to 80x growth over 5 years. I think you're disproving that theory.
Right. But I think that's where it's like people get too stuck on just the number without asking, like, what is it actually measuring? And so part of it is, what is, if someone just plays football and just subscribes to us during football and cancels at the end of the season, is that churn? I don't think so. I think it's only churn if they don't come back next season. Then they have left us. But like, if all they're doing is playing football and they play football with us for the season and then cancel, like, that's not churn. That is their like contract duration effectively. And like, if they leave before that, we messed up. But if they leave at the end of the season, like, no, like that's not necessarily the case. So seasonality plays a big role in that. And it makes it hard to measure what your like true churn is.
Do you track that? Think, like, do you tag the accounts based on what sports?
No, we should, but it's like, that's where one of the things that like, I go too far with not getting super deep into the metrics of just like, like these don't matter, but they do to an extent. And so like this year we're going to be building just like better tracking of that. Because I do think it'll be interesting at the very least to see it. I still need to figure out like how actionable it is.
Maybe it's like certain sports are churning more than others or something like that.
Yeah. So I think it's like, we want to like get more insights there. But it's at least conceptually, like we just more from the subjective side of it. It's like, when we get replies from people who are canceling, it's just like, hey, like season's over. Like I'll be back next season. Like, yeah, we don't then follow up to make sure they are back and everything else. I think that's a leak in the bucket. But that to me is not churn. But additionally, it's like, you're not churning. Churn is a blended metric. You were saying, out of all customers I have, the number of customers they have, how many cancel? Or out of all revenue we have, what percent cancel, like what percent does not renew for the next month? And it's not saying like, okay, yeah, but like this is not going to hold true at 20% for 100% of our customer base. What actually happens is that we have a very healthy top of funnel that is generating a lot of new customers. And they are churning at a very high rate. I mean, not like, well, I guess some people would say it would be insane, but like, say you have a 50% renewal rate after that first month. Okay, then what is it after the second month? What about after the third? And there is some point where like, they're staying. And I think there is a lot we can do on those earlier stages. But because we have healthy top of funnel, it's not an existential problem at all. It is a growth opportunity for us to figure out, how do we get these people who might not be, who might be like earlier in their journey, up to a place where they can benefit from our tools. But like every month we are still like adding long-term subscribers, and we have people that have been with us for years. But if you just put it in a spreadsheet and assume that percent holds steady across all customers, it's just like, no, that's not how it works. And it's the same thing on like advertising efficiency, where for churn, the people who are churning out are the worst customers just by definition. And so what remains are better customers than the ones that left. And at a certain point, all you have left are the diehards who are probably never going to churn. And it's very tough to figure out like, what is that kind of true plateau level of like, we could shut off new customer acquisition. What would our revenue be in a year, in 2 years? Like, what would that look like? And you could figure it out, but like, that is much higher than I think a lot of people assume when looking at a blended churn. But like in ads, it's like, okay, like if you are advertising to the same audience, it is going to get more and more expensive as time goes on, because the people who are most likely to buy have already bought, and the ones that remain are the least likely to buy. So it's just like, yeah, of course that's what happens. And I just think you got to take that step back and like, what are we actually measuring here? in this people with buying behavior. And I think that just gets lost in a lot of the kind of the spreadsheet math.
So how do you guys do a trial period on the product? And how do you, is it like product-led growth? Do you I'm assuming you don't do sales, right?
Yeah, we don't do sales, but it's so purely self-serve. We do a free 5-day trial. And I think there's more, well, not I think, there is absolutely more we can do to help those trial users set themselves up for success and stick around. And so that's like a weak point. But it's a question of then, is it worth it? Like, do we want to find ways to get the people who are succeeding to get them more successful and to be happy to pay more money to us? Or do we want to focus our efforts on the people who, despite our like decent efforts, maybe not our best efforts, but decent efforts, aren't making it work? And I have always trended towards, no, make the successful people more successful. There's going to be some low-hanging fruit we can pick on the getting people activated. But I do think that's like the natural bucket people focus on when they really shouldn't. I think it's like you're fighting what the market is telling you. And it's like what the people are telling you. It's like these people are telling you like, no, I don't like this. And you're trying to be like, no, but you really should. And it's just like, if you have to convince someone to change their mind, that's really tough to do. You can prime them and help them so they don't come to that conclusion to begin with. But like, that's still really hard. When doing that is pulling away focus from the people who are like, yeah, I get this. This is awesome. You're not able to spend as much time on them. And I think ideally you can devote some resources to both camps, but if you're going to pick one, you should always pick the, how do you get, assuming you have enough people who are successful, it should be like, how do you get them more successful?
Yeah. And I think your market's pretty big. If I had to guess, I mean, FanDuel and, DraftKings, I haven't checked their market cap recently, but I think they were in the billions, at least during the COVID time. What's the TAM in your industry? It has to be a big TAM, right?
It's tough to say because every year that we grow, I kind of like adjust my like mental number higher. We can get to 8 figures. I'm not confident it could be mid 8 figures without dramatically changing our business model, because while the general daily fantasy sports market is large, the general market is not our customer. It's like it's like the serious hobbyist. And there's a lot of those. And I think that's what's gotten us here, is they've really been neglected. But it's not the whole market. It's definitely like a small subset of that. And so it's hard to say, but I think there's more, definitely more growth from where we're at by focusing there. But it's like what I always think about is how much do I spend on like golf a year? And I'm like, I like golf a lot, but like if you add in the country club, it gets wild. But like even on clubs, like I'm not even that nuts about it, but it's still going to be like on golf balls, on gloves, on all these other things. It's thousands, low thousands for me, but there are plenty of people that spend 10,000 plus if you factor in lessons, if you factor in trips, if you factor in all these other things. They don't expect to go pro. They don't think like, no, like this is their hobby, their passion about. They want to get better. They want to invest in the best equipment. And so I think for us, it's figuring out how do we cater to that person who this will include people who do make full-time livings from it and people who aspire to that and are willing to put in the work for it. But the typical customer, that's not what they're looking for. And so I think it's just figuring out what do they want out of this and how do we help give them that?
Yeah, that's really awesome. It's the one thing I wanted to go back to actually about this is the top of funnel stuff, because I think, you know, people are always trying to crack this, especially in the consumer SaaS world, like how to generate, you know, you talked about activation, like going to the pirate metrics, the acquisition, activation, what is it, retention, referral, revenue, I think is the pirate metric acronym, and stands for R. That's where the pirate comes from, for the listeners. But the, you know, a lot, like I don't have expertise in the consumer SaaS world. I'm more on the B2B side. And, I think a lot of people breaking into consumer SaaS for the first time feel like there's some sort of like wizardry to it. Like you're dealing with people's emotions more than, you know, like ROI or, you know, more concrete business fundamentals. So how do you like find, you know, how do you attract users to the top of your funnel? Like what channels do you find work? Have you done things that are more like out of the box, or is it more like the standard paid ad strategy, or what has worked for you?
Yeah, we've only just started experimenting with paid ads. And it's, I think what works for us is not going to be like broadly applicable to most of the like consumer SaaS because of our price point, is that like, while the lifetime value of our customers can be dramatically different than like a B2B SaaS at $300 a month, but it's still going to be dramatically more than a consumer SaaS charging $10 a month. And so we're able to, the payoff is high enough that we're able to kind of place a lot of bets that we have confidence in, but are hard to measure. Because it's like, we're not spending so much where it's like, we need the precise measurement to make sure it's working. It's like, we can track branded search, we can track other things. So a lot of what we do is focusing on being deliberate about generating word of mouth. I mean, part of that is just from the product, but like we have a strong community. We do a lot of giveaways and a lot of things that are fun to share for people, to talk about, that sort of thing. And then like, we can see an increase in branded search over that. We see influx of customers. We see like the self-reported, like kind of where did you hear from us things, to know that a handful of them are working. And then it's on YouTube is a big channel for us, in our market. That's, everyone's basically on YouTube and Twitter.
Content on YouTube or, okay.
Yeah. Awesome. And I don't think we did anything like groundbreaking there. Like we have a smaller channel, but I think the ROI of our channel is higher than any of our competitors. I would bet a lot on that. But it's like, we saw what everyone else was doing, and that was putting out shows of every day talking about the games coming up, who to look at, who to avoid, that sort of thing. And just like sports talk radio, but built for daily fantasy sports. And that gets listens, like in that is effective, but that content then is out of date tomorrow. And then you got to get back on the microphone and do it again and do it again. And I think it gets expensive, but there are results there. But for us, it was just like, I'm not that bigger than life personality who's going to be exciting and that people want to watch. And like, that's just not me. There's no one on our team. And so I'm not going to try to create that content. I don't want to create that content. And then even if we do, how are we going to stand out when there's a bunch of people doing it really well? And so it's like, okay, like, yeah, let's just not do that. So then what do we feel like people are missing? And it just seemed like everyone was just heavily investing in that content that was definitely driving views, but they weren't thinking about like, what else can we do? And for us, it was like, it goes back to, I do have some background like content marketing of just like, what are the questions people are likely asking, but like not finding an answer to? What, like, if they want to get better at DFS, these live streams aren't really helping them there. It's almost like creating a dependency where they're going to have to come back tomorrow to get more advice and come back tomorrow to get more advice. And so we just created more evergreen content for the different sports. But like here, this isn't meant to tell you what to do today. This is meant to help you figure out how to think about DFS so that day in, day out, you can build a winning strategy. And I think that stands out in the market and gets attention from the right people. So that even if our views don't have like our videos don't have tens of thousands of views, I think the thousands that some of them get are the right thousands. And so we've kind of intentionally avoided just traffic and audience above all else and just been deliberate about where do we build there. But that's something that we're going to keep investing in a bit more deliberately and a bit more measurably, but sort of that's kind of how it is. It's not like a clear cut, oh, these three things did this, but it's by having a higher lifetime value, we're able to say like, it's kind of like an ads where you're looking at like an overall marketing spend to figure out like, okay, like what is the ratio of the spend to what we're making? And it's like, that's kind of how we view this. It's like, we're not doing anything other than these things. Is that generating consistent leads that are coming in? Cool. Like, let's figure out how to do them better and see if there are ways we can measure it more. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that answer of it depends is so true with any business. Like there's so many different channels and the channels are all very different. Like even the platforms you use, you know, some companies do really well leveraging Twitter. Right. Some companies do really well leveraging Reddit or Quora and answering questions. And, you know, some cold email, obviously not in the consumer space, but in the B2B space. So like every channel and strategy around that channel, I think is so different for every business. I'm curious, have you ever done anything with influencers for SaberSim?
Yeah, so for influencers, like our, I think there's more we can do here and want to do here, but it's figuring out the right way to incentivize them. And so we do partner with a few, I guess, yeah, influencers in the space where it's like we can tell them like, hey, we're not going to compete with you on this kind of content. You sell your own subscriptions and you basically you sell advice while we sell tools and strategy. And the strategy the more we give away. But what we incentivize them effectively just like on an affiliate deal. And so say like, hey, like promote SaberSim, we can embed SaberSim into your member portal effectively, and then give your customers a seamless experience. It's still SaberSim branded, it's not white labeled, but it's like, let us focus on the software side of it and the data side and all of that. You guys focus on the audience and that side. And so it's worked well. What's been a challenge is just no one's going to sell something as well as you yourself can. And it's finding the resources internally to really get them up to speed and then making sure that they have the resources to like we could at the point we're at now, we have the team and the bandwidth where like we could devote more time to assisting the partners on selling SaberSim. But it's not always like they have a bunch, they've got a business to run too. And so it's like finding the right balance of like, how do we make this win-win, which we have, but like, how do we, if it's not the top priority, it's going to be hard to kind of influence what they're doing too much, but it's still been effective. I just feel like there's some left on the table there.
How much of your business is coming from these affiliate channels?
Not a ton. So it's probably like 10%.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not nothing, but it's maybe 15%, I guess. Yeah. But it's like, that's with not a ton of, or just with effectively like no coordination. And so that's where I'm like, that to me is one of those speculative bets that you place. We're getting traction and it's like, yes, it's probably worth it for us to try to figure out like how do we double what they're doing.
Yeah, my gut is telling me that affiliate could be like a really big channel for the industry you're in. But I'm not in the industry, so it's just
it definitely is, and especially because like that is not the content we produce or want to. So it says like let the ones that are doing it do what they do best. But then it's just like, oh shit, like we don't have experience with affiliate management. We don't know, like, it's not that it's super complicated, but it's more like, how do we double down on this without it becoming a massive distraction? Because like, if we double that from, they become 20% of the revenue, like that's significant, but like, I'm pretty sure we can find ways to grow more than, I guess what that would add would be like the 10%. So it's like, and I'm more confident in it, and I know that we have the team to do it. So that's where it hasn't yet bubbled to the top. But honestly, like, that's a lot of what I'm working on is I view things in a this or that perspective more than is needed. And it's like in the early days when it was Matt and I, and then John, who was a contractor working with us, still with us full time today. But it was like, no, we all did everything. It was like, and it really wasn't even until like the last year or two where for me, it was all the profits were being reinvested in hiring engineering. And so I was doing a bunch, but I need to figure out how to get myself out of it more and more so that it's like, yeah, this is a good thing to double down on. I don't have to do this. Let's find the person that can, but just not there yet. And so it's been like placing fewer bets than I think we can.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still the growth you guys have had is just super impressive to me. Especially from where it was and where you've taken it. And I'm curious, like you've executed this so well over the last 4 to 5 years, just, you know, your strategy, like the way you think about things. Did you build other companies before SaberSim, or is this your first company?
No, this is my first company, but I think like I have a strong strategic mindset. I read an insane amount, or like podcasts, audiobooks, whatever else, but it's like if I'm not with family, it's like if I'm doing a chore, if I'm doing anything else, like I'm listening to something. I feel like I do well with like synthesizing, getting the first principles, figuring out like, okay, what is the actual lesson from this? How could this apply in other ways? And kind of building like a mental model of how to think about things. So I think like strategically, we've been quite strong. I think the execution side, the practical side is where there's been a lot of speed bumps and like where I really need to focus. And also like, I just overthink things a lot too. And that can just slow us down. And it's like, I shoot for perfection a bit more than is healthy. And so it's like, I can slow things down and miss kind of the forest for the trees sometimes. But it's, yeah, haven't done this elsewhere, but have been thinking about this and studying this for a very long time. It was like the last few years of poker, I was playing 50, 60 hours a week online, and I was basically a human robot and was getting burnt out, but it was like, I didn't have to, very rarely would I have to like pause and think about what to do. And I would literally read books. I would read message board posts. I would read everything I get my hands on and kind of just like gave myself the MBA, and then, worked with a couple small bootstrap companies, just kind of like start applying it. And then that helped accelerate things, but it really wasn't until buying SaberSim that, I think everything came together more and it was like, oh, okay, these are the things I was thinking were just dumb. And I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff I think now that's just like in a year, I'll be like, oh, that was stupid too. But, yeah, it's just I've spent an unhealthy amount of time thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the recipe for success as an entrepreneur, is to be obsessed. I mean, you just literally just eat, sleep and breathe it every day, because you can't not, you know, that's the trait that makes entrepreneurs successful, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And it really is a double-edged sword. But for now, at least trying to get more of that balance. But I think it's just kind of part of who I am, is like, this is my hobby. Like, this is what, like for our customers, their hobby is DFS. For me, mine is business.
Did you play poker professionally before SaberSim, or did you like work a career or anything, or?
So I basically played poker professionally for about almost exactly 10 years, I think, and then got into daily fantasy sports. And the difference between poker and DFS is, broadly speaking, there's some caveats to this, but like in poker, you are at the table playing if you want to earn. For DFS, it's closer to investing, where the work is done up front, but once your lineups are in, there's nothing left to do. And there are some games where that's not the case, but generally speaking, especially when I first got into it, that was the case. And so I just had a lot more time on my hands. And that was when I started working, just kind of a like freelancing with small startups. And I worked at Groove, was my like, if I have a resume, it would be like Best Buy in high school, poker for 10 years, a few like lightweight freelance marketing things. And then I worked at Groove, which does help desk software for small businesses, as a marketer for a bit over a year, and then bought SaberSim.
Dude, that's a hell of a resume, man. I'd hire you for sure.
It's been interesting, but I think like the biggest lesson I've learned with all this stuff is like, I overthink things. And every time I take a leap, I was like, fuck, I should have done this a while ago. I've learned so much more. And it's like, you can just kind of really test those assumptions and everything else. That's my biggest takeaway, really.
Well, Andy, this episode has been full of gold. I think anyone that made it all the way to the end here has probably learned like three or four directly applicable things for their companies. You know, before we wrap up, is, you know, any plugs you want to do for SaberSim or anything else you want to plug?
No, I don't really have many plugs. I mean, yeah, I guess if you're interested in DFS, if you want to get better results on DraftKings or FanDuel, check out SaberSim.com. But honestly, like, yeah, just happy talking about these things. It's like, I don't even know if I have 100 followers on Twitter. I don't have an ask. So,
well, good deal, man.
Cash flow. Did you clear your cash flow?